This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Our show is called Main Street because our microphones create one all across the state this time of day. The real Main Streets that are the centerpieces of our communities are where we greet each other and talk about what's on our minds, you know, share our news and opinions, because those Main Streets are the cores of our communities. That's where the churches were built, the corner cafe, the businesses, and the schools, probably not too far away, because education is a vital enterprise everywhere across this state. And a month ago on Main Street, we previewed the new Cutting Ed podcast. It's a collaboration of Prairie Public, North Dakota United, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Dintersmith. Institutions like schools may change slowly, but innovation is about adapting quickly, and that can make innovation in education difficult. Addressing that difficulty is one of North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum's main initiatives. And he visits with Tom Gerhart in this conversation from the Cutting Ed podcast.
I wanted to start with a statement that you made from the State of the State, your State of the State address, which I think says a lot, and I'll quote you. "Together, I believe North Dakota can lead the way in education across America. Our schools can be world-class in preparing students for the 21st century. Let me say that again. North Dakota schools can be the best in the world." And you were emotional when you talked about education in the State of the State address. I wanted you to talk a little bit about your passion for education, but especially through the lens of innovation.
My mom was an educator, and so I understand the role it can play. And with all the changes that are coming in this world, if students today and adults, I mean, we're talking about lifelong learning, but if you have the right skills, the world today represents just unbelievable potential for any individual to really design and create a life, do things that were unimaginable that are for our grandparents. And if you don't have those skills, life on this little planet can be pretty awful. And the difference between those two paths for people is education. So the work has enormous purpose, and it's going through a lot of change right now. And I think North Dakota has the opportunity to be nimble. My belief that we can be the best in the world is really a statement that we as North Dakotans can react and respond to the changes and the opportunities better than everyone else.
There seems to be a lot of confidence in how we are positioned moving forward. Now, we have a lot of work to do. But you feel good about where we are, the foundation we've built?
Yeah, we've had Ted Dintersmith in the state multiple times, and I think he's about as solid of a external validator as you could have, because he's been to all 50 states. And so when Ted says, "Hey, look, we've got greater opportunity for collaboration here between the organizations, whether it's PTA, school boards, teachers, superintendents, school administrators, taxpayers, parents, legislators, DPI, higher ed. I mean, there's a level of collaboration possible in North Dakota that's not possible, and it doesn't exist in other states. Now, can we take that small state nimbleness, that level of collaboration, and can we use it to actually make, constructive, positive steps forward to respond to the change? Because I think the change is coming faster and harder than most humans anticipate, and that's what's going to stretch us is how willing are we going to be able to let go of the past to be able to reach for the future?
The legislature passed Senate Bill 2186 this session, the Education Innovation Bill, as it's known. Last spring, you signed the bill, and you called it a crucial step in the right direction. Talk about that.
I think the Senate Bill 2186 was a crucial step in the right direction because it's really about empowerment, and it's an empowerment at the right level. It's empowering teachers and school boards and parents at the local level to make decisions. And if you want to design an organization to be nimble and able to respond to changes, you want to have decentralized decision-making so you can have a lot of different choices being made at the front lines. And so this is the just exact opposite of a federal Washington, D.C., one-size-fits-all approach. And what's going to be exciting is when you have a lot of different schools and school districts pursuing innovation, a year from now, we're going to have a bunch of different examples of learning what works. And that's what we want to have. Innovation is not about one way. It's about multiple ways and then being able to share and learn from each other.
And you talked about nimble and being able to adjust. That's, I think, what's really critical about this Senate Bill 2186. You can be a small school in a small town or a large school in a large community in North Dakota and have the flexibility, as you mentioned, to make those decisions from the ground up.
There's one district that encompasses about seven towns called Northern Cass. And one of the things that they're doing, they're putting together for eighth and ninth graders where they're going to have teachers of different disciplines in the same classroom. Project-based learning, hands-on learning, where you can have a math and a science and an English teacher all in the same room. And over the course of the project, kids are going to learn how to write. They're going to learn how to do math. They're going to learn what was the underlying physics underneath it. And that cross-disciplinary learning, again, is that's the way the world works. And it's also about teams. When we hire people in any 21st century job today, the first thing you do is you get assigned to a team because things happen in teams, whether it's, you know, building a Tesla, you know, car, or whether it's, you know, writing a piece of software, it happens in a team. And a lot of the education system has been around individual and individual assessment. And we've got to figure out a way to basically deliver, you know, hands-on, experiential, team-based learning, real-world examples for kids. And that can happen in a small school district like the one that I grew up in, or it can happen in the biggest ones. And that's also what's exciting.
Let's talk about what you've done for education innovation since you took office and Education Summit this past June to start things off.
Well, that was, I think, a great success. Nearly 500 people attended. We had great speakers from both in-state and out-of-state talking about national trends. And it wasn't just speakers talking to an audience. There was lots of breakouts, lots of engagement, and there was, you know, action items and things that came from that. We're going to be having our second Governor's Conference on Innovation and Education the first half of June and hope to have even a bigger group of people there. And we're going to have a set of innovation awards. And so we've sort of laid the groundwork for that. We've sort of put out the call, give people thinking about how we can highlight with actual recognition about what people are doing. And then we've also put out a challenge. I mean, the Senate Bill 2186, you know, our goal would be have at least 20 school buildings or districts that have put together an innovation plan that say, hey, here's what we want to try to do for next year. And we've got this idea. We've got approval moving forward. I think that's a bare minimum. With the 180 plus districts in our state, I'd love to see a higher number, but we're hoping to see some of these early adopters that were ready to go right out of the chute, get out and create some great examples that the rest of us can learn from.
You also formed an innovative education task force that was announced recently. Again, folks from across the state from different disciplines, and that will help set the stage for what you hope to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely will. And we were so blessed in the sense that we had over 150 very qualified people applied to be part of that task force. So I think that gives you a sense of the energy that was in it, you know, and it was teachers and superintendents and principals and parents and PTA leaders and private sector leaders. You know, youth learning organizations that we have that play an important role. I'm talking about whether it's, you know, organizations like FFA or 4-H or other learning organizations, some of the tech-based ones that are out there. There's lots of ways for kids to learn outside the classroom, but this is part of that. Some of those organizations are also delivering that hands-on experiential learning. But I think what we want to do is, you know, inspire innovation, highlight innovation, recognize innovation, promote innovation. And this group will help us think about, you know, how do we share best practices? How do we get innovation to just grow? And one of the things that we kicked around and talked about was this hashtag InnovateND. You know, we've got this group together created by executive order. There's no budget. There's no appropriation that goes with it. So how do you get things going? We don't have the money to hire someone. Let's create a website. Let's post this. But hey, we've got a hashtag, hashtag InnovateND. We're encouraging schools to just get out there and start using it and have that become a free location, a free pointer where everyone can talk every week about the cool things that are going on.
Listening to you, it seems like this is a time of incredible opportunity for teachers and learners.
A teacher in a classroom anywhere in North Dakota today has access to all the world's information virtually for free. And so how do we take all of that content? How do we deliver that? How do we figure out a way to craft new learning opportunities? And again, it's not just, you know, watching a video. It's also, you know, hey, we watch a video, but here's a hands-on, you know, real-world experience project where people are going to do learning. And I think in each community, if you're in coal country, you know, there's opportunities with that industry. If you're in ag country, there's opportunity with that. If you're in the oil country, I mean, you know, how do we get kids to even understand the economy of our state and the history of our state? I mean, I think we've, you know, seen in this last year that there's been kind of a gap on understanding about the Native American history in our state and, you know, the traditions and all that. I mean, I think there's an opportunity to, you know, not just teach a segment in fourth grade in North Dakota history, but, you know, how do we build that into a curriculum in a way where, again, it's hands-on, experiential, real learning where we can really understand each other in our state, understand the industry, understand our economy, understand how the world works.
I've heard a lot of talk about passion areas. How did you find your passion growing up?
I would say in terms of finding the passion, I was undecided. I mean, I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was in high school. And I had, you know, two parents that had gone to NDSU and two siblings had gone to NDSU, and my dad had passed away when I was a freshman in high school, and my mom had gone back to work at NDSU, and I was living out in Arthur, and so, I mean, I could go to any school I wanted to as long as it was NDSU. I mean, that was the kind of the range of that possibility. But while I was there, then I was studied university studies, which was a new thing, which was meant to be for undecided freshmen. I just stuck with it for 4 years and was one of the first graduates of NDSU with a Bachelor of University Studies. Get on the bus. I used to say that BUS degree, but it was, yeah, it's not a BA, it's not a BS, it's a bus. Get on the bus. Anyway, but I was undecided. Then I went to grad school, which I kind of discovered midway through my senior year, actually from reading a Forbes magazine that an advisor gave me. And I didn't know what an MBA was until about February of my senior year, and made a last ditch application to go to a graduate school of business, got into a terrific one. But there you didn't have to declare a major, which is perfect. So 2 more years after that. And then, you know, my first job after grad school was for a global company called McKinsey, which did consulting for lots of industries. So I also didn't have to really decide what I wanted to do. And then while I was working at McKinsey, I was crunching numbers on a physical spreadsheet with a little, you know, Texas Instrument hand calculator. Later had a little HP 12C hand calculator, which was a little better, had more functions on it. But we were, you know, doing this, you know, hand number crunching is what we were doing for clients, doing analysis. And I walked by a corner office, and there was this gentleman named Adil Zainalbhai, nicknamed Scratch. He was had an Apple II computer and VisiCalc, which was an early spreadsheet, electronic spreadsheet, one of the first ones. And he was like, hey, look at this. And he, you know, hit a button and the thing crunched for about 5 minutes and spit out a spreadsheet, and it was, you know, better than the one that I had just spent 10, 12 hours working all night on. And I was like, wow, you know, where'd you get that? You know, the firm buy that? And he's like, no, I got it at a computer store. You know, I bought it. So he had gone, bought this thing himself at a computer store and was using it as a tool. And so some people had later said, oh, you were such a visionary to get into software, PC software in the earliest days. And that was, I said, that was, there was no vision there. I mean, I got hit in the forehead with a 2x6, you know, that basically said what you're doing is going to get completely disrupted by this new technology, and you better get out of what you're doing and get into that thing. And so that was the moment when I just said, hey, I got to figure out a way to get into the PC software business, because I knew it was going to change everything.
You mentioned North Dakota kids. I mean, in the end, looking to the future, education, innovation, that's what this is all about, better preparing our students for the future, making them ready for the world.
Yes, absolutely. And I think one thing that did inspire me over the 30 years I spent in software was I did see that kids from North Dakota could, you know, with given the right opportunities to learn and the right challenges, they could compete with anybody in the world. I mean, that's why we could build a world-class companies here in some of the most competitive sectors imaginable. And so that gives me a lot of excitement, a lot of hope, and a lot of passion that we can do that in our education system. And because I know that talent's out there, and I know that if you create that spark for people, they can get it and go and keep on going. But I do think the challenges, I mean, we've been focusing on K through 12, but you know, this is really a world where, you know, if you graduated from college 20 years ago, a lot of what you learned is not relevant anymore. So that's not really about equipping just the K through 12 students and getting them ready to be choice ready when they graduate. But it's also about how do we reinvent and redeliver how we do higher education, and how do we create ourselves as a state where we do lifelong learning? Because this is, you know, as we're designing learning systems, you know, for all these students, I'm hoping there's a spillover, you know, to the adult population where we all have to, you know, maintain those elements of lifelong curiosity, you know, that idea that you keep asking questions. And that's one thing I, you know, would share as a parent. You know, a lot of times dropping kids off at school in the morning, I was never the guy that said, you know, hey, get good grades. And I was never the guy that even said, have perfect attendance, because I couldn't point to myself for that. I was on the attendance side of things. And, you know, I think, you know, the thing that matters in a world where you can look up any answer anytime, any place, then being able to regurgitate an answer didn't ever appear to me to have a lot of value. And that's sort of the traditional model, is we're going to teach you and then we're going to test whether you can cough that answer up again. And so I, you know, said to my kids every day when I drop them off, it's a family joke. You know, now if you ask any of them, what did your dad say when he dropped you off at school? I would say, ask good questions. That's all I would tell them. I said, you know, hey, have a good day, ask good questions. Then when they come home at night or having dinner, I'd say, tell me the best question you asked today. And we were trying to, again, trying to maintain a culture of curiosity around that. Then, you know, I'd go to parent-teacher conferences, and if it was a new teacher, the first thing they'd say is, wow, your kid asks really hard questions. And I'd say, good, that's all I need to know.
Change can be intimidating. What advice would you give to students and teachers as we move forward, embark on this innovative education journey?
Use the word intimidating. I think change induces fear. I mean, it just does in humans. And it doesn't mean whether, you know, if it's change in job description, a change in your, you know, get a new principal, new superintendent, you know, for students, I got a new teacher. I mean, it's a fear inducing thing. And so the other thing, in addition to curiosity that we have to cultivate as a state, is we actually have to cultivate daily courage. You have to have people who are willing to have the courage to face new things, try new things, get outside your comfort zone. I mean, if we're going to navigate a world that in the next 10 years changes way more rapidly than the last 10, and that's a key point, because the changes in the private sector, in government, in education, in healthcare, in agriculture, in energy, all these things that are transforming rapidly, they're being driven by digital transformation. And the underlying digital transformation is driven by Moore's Law, which is that computer chips double in power and cost half as much, you know, every 18 to 24 months. That's why we all can walk around with supercomputers, you know, in our pocket. I mean, that's what we've all got. I mean, and these things are, you know, more powerful than, you know, the fill the room supercomputers that existed in the 1970s. I mean, these things are just ridiculous. I mean, so you could be like a fourth grader. Between your fourth grade and your senior year, entire industries get completely turned upside down. Well, people think that's not going to happen to education. I mean, it's going to happen. Example, recently I was talking with Forbes, Rich Carlgaard, who's here from Bismarck, was, you know, coming through the state. And Forbes has always been viewed as a media company. They've got the magazine. They've got other things. They've got this brand. They said, hey, well, if people are reading a Forbes magazine, not to get a stock price, because they can get that online, they're reading a Forbes magazine article about a CEO, they're reading it because they want to learn. So maybe we're actually an education company. We're not a media company. We're an education company. So then they team up with a small liberal arts college in Iowa who's doing the accreditation on the back end. They put out a brand that said, we're going to have an online business school called Forbes Business School. They have 19,000 students in less than 18 months, you know, delivering, you know, all the best content.
You mentioned earlier how much you're looking forward to seeing what ideas teachers and students and school districts come up with looking forward. When you look at defining success of Senate Bill 2186 or where we're at in education right now in North Dakota, what gets you excited? What defines success?
Well, you know, what excites me is knowing that we have, you know, frontline teachers and administrators, school boards that really believe and are passionate about delivering the best educational opportunity possible. I think people that understand at a deep level that this change is happening and we've got to respond. And I think for me, at the end of the day, the excitement is when I see the students and when you see the teachers, when you see people light up with excitement about what they're doing, and that idea that you get up in the morning and you want to go to school. When you're a teenager, you're excited to get there. Not just because you're friends and because of the other activities, but you're excited because the learning is exciting. The projects you're working on is interesting. It's relevant. That's exciting to me. I mean, so part of what we have to do is get people excited about the fact that we're on the leading edge of what we're doing in energy and agriculture and technology and healthcare. I mean, there's a lot of leading edge stuff going on here. You know, the UAS stuff we're doing, which spans all kinds of industries. So again, I want to make sure that we get that. Not only get the spark of learning, but we connect that spark of learning back to the fact that it's cool to be from North Dakota. And it's, you know, this is a place where you want to live and work. And one of the things, I mean, one of these towns, I think it was Rugby, Lieutenant Governor Brent Sanford was up there, and the kids were doing a presentation, and the kids in the high school had done a study on, here's what we think we should redo to our Main Street. You know, here's the activities we wish we had. Here's the buildings we should save. You know, here's the infill projects, you know, where buildings got torn down, if we should fill that in with, you know, either a building or a park or something in between. And, you know, those kids will remember that project. And for the adults, there's some learning, because they can kind of go, hey, if we want these kids to grow up and stay here, maybe we should implement some of these ideas that the students came up with. Well, that could all be built into You know, Senate Bill 2186, you know, innovative learning. That could be a hands-on experiential thing that is, you know, let's take this square feet, let's calculate it, let's do the economics. What does it cost to do start up a business? How do we get the capital? How do you hire people? You know, what do we do? What's the business model? Where do we tie in with tourism? Where do we tie in with economic development? You know, is it, you know, value-added ag or energy? I mean, there's, I mean, you could just take one idea like that and it could turn into everything you need to learn. So then when the students graduate, they actually maybe could be the next entrepreneur, innovator, you know, that could do that. And they might decide to do it in a small town in North Dakota because they know they can.
You can listen to more of the conversation between Governor Doug Burgum and Cutting Ed host Tom Gerhart and hear other discussions online at ndunited.org/thecuttinged. Coming up on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
Support is provided by Nodak Mutual Insurance Company, with over 60 agents throughout North Dakota, ready to answer your insurance questions. Nodak Mutual has agents with answers. Online at nodakmutual.com.
Coming soon, the winners of the 2017 Third Coast Competition, the best audio documentaries of the year.
Can you see me? Blink once for yes.
I go at night so that I can't be seen.
Police are seen.
The dash cam video reveals the sequence of events during this critical minute.
Stand by for police.
Listen for Best of the Best from the Third Coast Festival here on your public radio station.
Best of the Best 2017, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Every place on Earth has plant and animal life uniquely suited to it. Some are easy to observe, but many aren't noticed because we aren't looking. Chuck Lura is. He teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau and writes our Natural North Dakota essays. Today, he's taking us to lakes and ponds to discover a vital form of natural wildlife.
A few years ago, I was involved with an ecology exercise for elementary students. We waded out into a lake, scooped up some of the substrate with pie plates, and observed all the little critters that were hidden amongst the substrate and overlying detritus. As you might expect, there were lots of little invertebrates, such as crustaceans and insects. Then we explained how these invertebrates are important components of the aquatic food chain, and how, as such, are important food items for game fish we so enjoy. One of the more conspicuous groups of these little critters was what's commonly known as scuds. These scuds have no connection with the scud mussels. These scuds are small crustaceans, close relatives of crayfish, shrimp, and lobster. Some people also know them as freshwater shrimp, or side swimmers, or perhaps gammarus, the genus to which they belong. Scuds are small members of the group of crustaceans called amphipods. There are about 10,000 species in the group. Most are marine, but about 20% are freshwater species. They may be found in a wide variety of aquatic habitats, but generally are found at or near the bottom of the body of water where they feed on detritus, dead plant and animal material. As such, they're important detritivores, reducing the buildup of dead material at the bottom of the body of water and returning the nutrients back into the food chain to perhaps eventually become tasty flesh of bluegills, perch, or walleye. Scuds are generally between a fourth of an inch to three-fourths of an inch long. They're whitish in color with perhaps some darker markings. They have two pair of antennae, gills, and a pair of legs, with the front legs modified for grasping and function as accessory mouthparts. The rest of the legs function in swimming and creating little water currents to flow over the gills. Some of these legs are oriented forward, while those further back are oriented backwards. Ice anglers occasionally will see these scuds come swimming up the holes in the ice. They're also occasionally observed when fishing during other seasons. The abundance of these scuds is an indication that there are probably some happy, well-fed fish in the body of water. Moreover, if all goes well, the anglers will happily enjoy a meal of freshly caught fish. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, a Harvest Public Media report about grass-fed beef. Chef Rosie talks about more food trends for 2018. And Ashley Thornburg and I look at our What's Happening calendar of events. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. East Grand Forks fire officials say it's too soon to put a damage estimate on last night's elevator fire at MCI, but it will be expensive. Crews were called to the scene shortly before 7 p.m. on a report of an explosion. Assistant Chief Jeff Anderson says the fire broke out in the filter house near the top of the building.
And, you know, with all the tubes and the blower system they have, it, you know, that can spread the different parts of the storage areas. And so we were there for, you know, till 11 o'clock last night with thermal imagers, you know, running, following all those tubes and everything. And once we determined everything was okay, we pulled out of there. And
Anderson says while most crew members returned to the station by 11 p.m., a fire watch team remained on scene until 6 this morning. There were no injuries. As far as the cause,
the fire itself isn't suspicious in nature. It's probably more like a mechanical something, you know, in-house that they'll probably determine with the equipment and asking them if they have any idea what may have caused it.
Anderson says he has left the damage estimate of his report blank for now.
Substantial damage up on that whole unit on the rooftop, so I'm sure it's not cheap to replace and repair, especially this time of year with the condition, with the weather and stuff.
Anderson says it's never fun fighting a fire in the winter, but it really wasn't too bad last night. -4 with calm winds. North Dakota's taxable sales and purchases showed a slight increase in the third quarter of 2017. Tax Commissioner Ryan Rauschenberger says for July, August, and September, taxable sales were more than $4.7 billion. That's a 2.3% increase over those same months in 2016. Rauschenberger attributes the increase to oil production in western North Dakota.
Oil prices started coming back up. We had strong oil production this summer. The oil sector was up 80% compared to the year before, which had a huge positive impact year to year.
Rauschenberger says retail was down slightly in that quarter, and he says the numbers were not as robust in central and eastern North Dakota.
We've seen lower construction numbers in the eastern part of the state, and we had so much construction throughout North Dakota, really in those 2015 and 16 years. That isn't surprising because we had some large, very large construction projects finish up in, you know, in that 2016 time frame, really 2017 time frame. So now we're comparing a quarter where there isn't as much construction compared to a quarter where there was.
Rauschenberger says taxable sales fell 6% in Fargo and were also down slightly in Bismarck and Grand Forks. And January is Birth Defects Prevention Month, and North Dakota Department of Health is joining several national groups to bring awareness to it. Devaya Mukutira is an epidemiologist with the health department. He says January is all about focusing on bringing awareness to actions that can be taken to prevent birth defects, such as vaccination, staying healthy, and preventing insect bites. Mukutira says while there is plenty you can do to prevent birth defects, there are some that can't. That can't be, since there are not any known causes.
We don't know what causes it. Most of them, some of them are genetic, you know. So those ones are you cannot prevent, but you can be aware of it. You can see that. You can visit the physician and see that if your family or members in your family or your who have these type of defects, then the doctor would look at it and see the preventive measures by monitoring the growth of the fetus as the baby is growing.
In the U.S., a baby is born with a defect every 4.5 minutes, which accounts for 120,000 babies a year. Mukutira says 108 babies were born with defects in North Dakota in 2016. He says birth defects are the most common cause of death in babies less than a year old and the second leading cause of death of children between ages 1 and 4. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Direct Travel Satrum Tours, offering a Baltic cruise and Orion cruise in June 2018. Also offering two comprehensive Alaska land and sea tours in July and August 2018. More information at 1-800-833-8787 or satrumtravel.com.
I wondered what I could possibly say to lessen the impact of this fiasco, but I stayed silent. I'm originally from New England, and this is a common strategy. We pretend something hasn't happened by not talking about it.
Join us for more true stories told live. The theme, high anxiety. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The sales of grass-fed beef have soared in recent years, from $17 million in 2012 to $272 million in 2016. Advocates say raising cattle as much as possible on grass instead of bulking them up with grain at feedlots leads to beef that's healthier and better for the environment. Yet that very grass may be changing in ways that'll affect the future of grass-fed and conventional beef alike. Alex Smith reports for Harvest Public Media.
A few years ago, Kansas City restaurateur Anton Kotar was surveying the local and national restaurant scenes and concluded his town's reputation as a steakhouse paradise had slipped.
When you're in New York or you're in Miami, they talk about their stuff. They don't talk about, oh, in Kansas City, there's this one.
Kotar says the problem with many steakhouses is the same problem with the beef industry overall. Most beef cattle spend a good part of their lives eating grain or soybeans rather than being raised entirely on grass like they once were. This has made beef cheap and plentiful, and it's changed the flavor we expect from beef. But Kotar thinks it's flooded the market with low-end steaks.
And I think that some of our best steakhouses chased the quality of the beef to the bottom.
If the idea that more grass equals better steaks is true, there's trouble out west. The grass in the Great Plains may be getting less nutritious.
Yeah, so what we have left by now is just this dry, senesced grass.
And this might 120 have... miles to the west, researcher Joe Crane trots through the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve in central Kansas. From the road, the prairie looks like an unbroken wave of green. But kneeling down, Crane grabs a handful of grasses to show how diverse they actually are, containing hundreds of different species. The prairie is so diverse, in fact, that to study it, Crane and researchers from Texas A&M University don't actually study the plants themselves.
Somewhere on the order of 50,000 cow pies that got shipped down to Texas for this study.
Crane studies poop that was collected everywhere from Texas to Kansas to Montana between 1994 and 2016. He says he's seen a trend in the quality of the grasses these cattle are eating. Since the mid-90s, levels of crude protein, which cattle need to grow, have dropped by nearly 20%.
If we were still back at the forage quality that we would have had 25 years ago, no less 100 years ago, our animals would be gaining a lot more weight.
Crane suspects rising carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are playing a part in what he's seeing. Increased CO2 levels have been linked to decreasing nutrients in plants like rice, wheat, and potatoes, and he thinks this may be happening on a large scale in the prairie. Crane says it could just be a matter of time before prairie grasses simply don't have enough protein to support grazing.
Pretty soon you're at the point where the protein concentrations are too low for too long a period for the animals to gain any weight.
It is an interesting hypothesis.
Jerry Valesky is a grass researcher with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He uses a different method of measuring health of grasses, and he's skeptical about studying manure for nutritional trends. But he thinks Crane may have a point about rising carbon dioxide. It causes plants to grow bigger, but the amount of nitrogen that makes plants nutritious doesn't change.
Now, on a native rangeland or grassland, nitrogen is the nutrient that is probably most limiting. There just seems to be enough to get by with each year.
Crane says work needs to be done to parse out the causes and effects, but if the trends he's seen continue, beef producers may need to dump huge amounts of nitrogen across the Great Plains if it's going to have the protein needed to raise cattle. A 25-ounce grass-fed bone-in filet sizzles on the grill at Anton's taproom. Grass-fed beef is more expensive than conventional beef, but industry analysts say grass-fed could make up 30% of the beef market in 10 years. Feeding that demand, however, could be a lot more complicated and expensive if prairie grasses continue to decline. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Alex Smith.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on America's farm and rural issues. Chef Rosie is next.
Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network. We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR News, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so, we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Chef Tim Rosendahl. We're talking about food and food trends.
And we have been having this discussion for a few weeks, and we've talked about a lot of ideas from reducing waste to cleaner menus to fast casual. And we are going to focus now on a topic item that you are just calling simplicity. Back to basics. What do you mean by that?
You know, back to basics, I think of going to cooking school and running a cooking school. We always thought of we never want to teach the kids just recipes, because recipes we can follow, we can buy books, we can read them on the internet. It's about teaching them cooking methods to know how to properly bake or broil or steam or grill or poach or fry or whatever it is. But they all have little things that you have to do that. A perfect example is one to talk about would be stir fry. Mm. Look at all the Asian, Chinese, Japanese, Vietnamese, Thai restaurants that you go to that stir fry. Well, surprise, surprise, they all have woks, and most of those have gas-fired woks, whether it's propane or butane or natural gas, and they have 40, 50, 60,000 BTUs.
Lots
of
heat.
I'm here to tell you that none of you have that in your house. That's a big statement. So trying to stir-fry in a little electric Hamilton Beach wok that has a little element on the bottom of it that can barely boil water in a few minutes is not stir frying. You are just steaming your product. Now, can you take a wok outside on your grill and turn your gas as high up as you can get, maybe 12 or 20,000 BTUs? That's as good as you're going to get. But it's really cooking really hot. Stir fry is really hot. And that's an example of one cooking method. Another one to talk about would be something whether we steam vegetables or we steaming seafood or poaching, understanding that when you poach something, you never bring it to a boil. Poaching is always under 180 degrees. So if you call it poaching salmon and I look over and there's a piece of salmon boiling on the stove or oysters or lobster, that doesn't work. You're not poaching that at all. You're boiling it and you're not making it any better. You're toughening the protein. You're constricting the muscles. It's never as good as when you simmer it or poach it. So understanding those cooking methods and coming back to the basics of there's restaurants now that have from the steamer, from the grill, from the broiler are stir-fried items. So you can actually pick out the one you want. And if you're much more health-oriented, you might stay away from the sauté and the pan fry and the stir fry and the, you know, because those all involve fat, oils, where when you think of steam or poach or grill, you think of, now I'm not adding any fat. And there's other downsides to that as well. When you grill food, of course, whether you're grilling over wood or charcoal or whatever you're using as a heat source, there's natural carcinogens in the charcoal that come, you know, the blackening of a steak or the charring of a chicken breast. But those are all things considered back to the basics of cooking. And now, of course, the new cooking method that's just taking the country by storm is sous vide cooking, mm-hmm. under pressure. Nothing more than your Ziploc bag, taking the broccoli that you normally poached in water or steamed and put it in a Ziploc bag and putting that in a much softer poaching water and cooking that till it's done to the exact temperature. So now we're not losing any of the vitamins or any of the minerals because we're not having the flavors go into the water. Now, if you say you're using that water to make a soup or a sauce, more power to you. but most of the time you're not.
Better take it out of the bag if you're going
right.
to do that.
Right, exactly. But it's simplicity, back to basics, and it's not just the cooking methods, but it's also the ingredients.
Well, you started with stir fry, and a piece of an important part of preparation for stir fry in Southeast Asia cultures is preparing it with a mortar and pestle. They got a lot of curry, you know. They grind the stuff. They get it ready.
Yeah, they grind it. When we're thinking of Asian foods and we think of Latina foods, they use the molcajete.
Yeah.
They're grinding the grains and grinding the salts and grinding the herbs and spices to bring out the natural flavor. We've all known for a long time that any herbs or spices that you can bring in the natural form, as in peppercorns, as in whole nutmeg, as in juniper berries, when you have the whole herb and spice, you retain much more of the flavor. Now you're grinding it. I'm saying grinding fresh, but we all know that the peppercorns in your cabinet that have been there since you graduated from college, you're not grinding fresh. But you're doing, if you've ever had Malabar peppercorns off the tree, you'll know what grinding peppercorns fresh is.
Does a mortar and pestle, is that... Like I'm just thinking about spice grinding, and if I've ground up some star anise and then everything I try to grind after that tastes like that. And I'm using an electric one. Am I going to be able to with a mortar and pestle? Is there something about it being marble or whatever those are made out of where they're not absorbing
mostly,
yeah, that flavor? Do you know what I mean? Or is there a way to have one spice grinder for multiple spices?
Oh, that's a two-hour discussion. Because in Mexico, they only use one type of mocajete just for the cacao bean, just okay, for chocolate. They use another one just for corn. And by the way, they're trained for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years.
Wow.
The young ladies and the young lads are trained for years by their mother or grandmother before they're allowed to grind the corn for the tamales and to make the – so – cross-flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Doug said, you know, a lot of them are granite, a lot of them are marble.
So and that's more sealed.
A perfect example is when you make Caesar salad in the dining room of a restaurant in a wooden bowl, and the first thing you do is mash the garlic on the wooden bowl. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm here to say that wooden bowl should become your Caesar salad bowl because you can wash it and you can scrub it and you can rub it with lemon and you can dry it, but at the end of the day, put your nose to it tomorrow morning, you're going to smell garlic. And the same thing with your fingers.
So well, you might want a couple different spice grinders if you're a real active spice grinder.
I don't know. There's not much I don't like garlic with, but the one I think of, but chocolate's a good example. Yeah. I don't want garlic with my chocolate. And star anise was another great example because that's a pretty strong flavor.
It's delicious, but
yes,
I don't want it overpowering.
But if you're making a curry,
something,
then you're mixing stuff anyway. You're actually
sure,
macerating it together.
Yeah, I think it's all relative into what you're making. If you have one, I mean, not many of us have more than one mortar and pestle.
Right.
You know, we have one, or maybe we have a large and a small, but, and a lot of people don't wash them out. They
yeah,
wipe them out and set it back on the shelf in the kitchen because they don't want water to be in it. So the answer to that is I'm not sure. I'm a politician. I think we talked around that as best we could.
All right. Well, if you have a question for Chef Rosie,
send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org.
And what's happening is next.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street Radio. This week I chat with Joanne Chang, owner of Flower Bakery in Boston, about how she used applied mathematics to create a successful chain of bakeries. Also up this week, our recipe for salmon with tomatoes and paprika, and Dan Pashman of The Sporkful ponders the question, is a slice of pizza a slice if it's too large to fold? Coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday at 1 Central, noon Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, that's the question we ask at this time of the week, every week, what's happening. And Ashley Thornburg and I have gone through a list, and we've got some ideas to share.
There is going to be some scrapbooking in Williston on Saturday at the Missouri Yellowstone Confluence Interpretive Center at the Fort Buford State Historic Site, and that is just outside of Williston. People who are really into scrapbooking, bring your own supplies for this class, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., and the cost is free. Get together with all sorts of people who like scrapbooking and get those holiday scrapbooks put together.
Sounds great. Well, the Fargo Library Readathon starts on Monday at all Fargo Library locations. The Fargo Public Library invites residents to chase away the chill of winter and make reading a winter sport by participating in the library's annual Winter Readathon. Participants can add mystery, adventure, and a little excitement to cold winter days. And to participate, you pick up an official book log at any Fargo Public Library location beginning on Monday. All ages are encouraged to read to earn small prizes while they last and chances to enter prize drawings. The hours are, of course, regular library hours, and the cost is right. It's free.
You probably know the band Journey. The lead singer is going to be performing Saturday in Fort Yates at the Prairie Nights Casino. The band Journey sold nearly 90 million albums worldwide. And the solo artist, you get to see the former lead singer Saturday, Fort Yates Prairie Nights Casino, 7:30 to 9:30 p.m., and the cost is just $30.
Well, here's one I know you covered, and I went to see this exhibit. It was well worth it. The St. John's Bible exhibit has been extended through February 4th. This is in Moorhead at the Heritage M. Combs Center. If you didn't have a chance to see the hand-illuminated and hand-calligraphed St. John's Bible at the M. Combs Center in Moorhead in 2017, well, it's moving into 2018. The Illuminating the Word, the St. John's Bible exhibition, has been extended through Sunday, February 4th. Unofficially, more than 10,000 people visited the exhibit through December. And while the extension could mean a few changes regarding which pages are on display due to strict rules about how many hours each page spends under light, the exhibit will include some combination of the 68 folios from the 7 volumes of this magnificent work. Monday through Saturday from 9 in the morning till 5 p.m. and Sunday from noon to 5 p.m. The cost is $15 for adults, $14 for seniors and college students, $10 for children. That's ages 5 to 17.
More than 10,000 people gone to see that. I know the executive director, they originally were kind of hoping for about 3,000 people. So hence the need for the extension there. The Art Minions Art Club is presenting Art from the Heart Saturday in Bismarck along Mandan Street here. This is an art club for kids ages 6 and up. Lots of different mediums that these kids can work in. They can either work individually or on group art projects, 10 a.m. to noon on Saturday in Bismarck at 311 North Mandan Street. And the cost is $15 for the Art Minions Art Club.
Well, Mom and Dad can go to the Art and Wine Painting Session this evening in Bismarck at the Theo Art School Studios. They're located at 1810 Schaefer Street in Bismarck. It's an evening of fun that's great for date night, girls' night, or just a friend's night out. Art Uncorked is a guided art-making experience, and if you're not sure of your artistic talent, if you're new to art, don't worry. Their instructor will guide you step-by-step through the evening's project. Just show up ready to laugh, talk, and have fun, and this is vital, bring your own. They don't serve it there, but you can bring your own. Uncorked. It runs from 6:30 to 8:30 this evening, and the cost is $15.
The Young Artist Solo Competition this Saturday in Moorhead at Concordia College. You can check out this area's rising musical stars as they perform at this annual competition. Musicians from grades 10 through 12 facing off for cash prizes and a spot to play with the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony at an upcoming concert. The finals for this are at 1 p.m. Saturday in Moorhead at Concordia College. It's free and open for the public to come and check out these young musicians on the rise.
Well, Kid Quest at the Plains Art Museum is this Saturday in Fargo at the downtown Plains Art Museum. It invites kids to look around the museum to find images and items they can use on their own superhero capes in an event called Pow, Bang, Boom, Heroes in Art. It's from 1 to 4 this Saturday. It is free, but registration is required, and you do that at www.plainsart.org.
Well, we have had a lot of great art exhibits for this week, and I am going to continue on that theme with my pick of the week, and that is that there is a new exhibit space opening in Minot at the Northwest Arts Center on the campus of Minot State University, showcasing contemporary art from across the nation and without forgetting our own talented regional artists in North Dakota, Montana, and Minnesota. So kick off the new year with this new exhibit space. You can check it out Monday through Fridays, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Northwest Arts Center on the campus of Minot State University. And it's free.
Well, yesterday we talked with Cottonwood's Jill Weiss about the upcoming 13th annual Blizzard Bluegrass Weekend. It is next Friday and Saturday. That's January 12th and 13th in Bismarck at the Sidney J. Lee Auditorium at Bismarck State College. Lots of bluegrass music in the evenings and bluegrass workshops on Saturday afternoon. Featured performers include Cottonwood, here from the Washburn and Bismarck-Mandan area, and High Plains Traditions, which is from Colorado. The concerts start at 7 Friday and Saturday evening. The workshop is from 2 to 4 on Saturday afternoon. The cost for those concerts, $15. And that's what's happening.
Too much happening. This is Dakota Datebook for January 4th. North Dakota remembers World War I. The 164th Army Infantry Regiment was an activated regiment of the North Dakota National Guard. In 1917, they spent Christmas at Winchester, England. Meanwhile, the 116th Engineers, comprised mostly of segments of the dismantled 2nd North Dakota Regiment, had their Christmas dinner in France, one step closer to the front lines. They, too, settled down to a turkey dinner with all the trimmings, with sermons delivered by the Reverend Herbert G. Markley, the fighting chaplain. Music was provided by the North Dakota Band, which had been assigned to the 116th. The trip to England and France for the North Dakota regiments began on December 12th. Shortly before they departed from American shores, the Kate Richards O'Hare trial began in Bismarck. It was not a good time to be on trial for crimes against one's country, notably in a rural state such as North Dakota. Patriotism ran high, especially when young men from the state would soon be at the front. Kate O'Hare had been arrested for making seditious remarks at a lecture in Bowman back in July. At that lecture, among other things, she stated that women who sent their sons to war were no better than brood sows. She also stated that the young men from North Dakota who enlisted were fit only to be fertilizer for French soil. It took less than a half an hour for a jury in district court to render a verdict of guilty. J.M. Wade, a judge from Iowa, had been called in for the trial. He decreed that Mrs. O'Hare should pay court costs and spend 5 years at the federal prison in Jefferson City, Missouri. However, she was allowed to post bond of $5,000 while waiting for her appeal. Kate O'Hare quickly branded the trial, the indictment, and the verdict as grotesque. When defending her actions, she stated that she did not deliver the lecture at Bowman in words that she would normally use. She would have used breeding animals in place of brood sows, and in place of fertilizer, she may have stated they were only fit to enrich the soil of France. But as she stood on the platform and sized up her audience, she had decided not to use the high-sounding phraseology that she might have employed in a more cultured setting. She was in Bowman, and she was attempting to talk Bowmanese. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
In the post-Weinstein era, there's still one question nagging Hollywood. Can it really change?
People say, wow, that place was always such a frat house. And that means that there's a pervasive culture of guys doing things together. And when they want to have that environment of boys having fun, they don't want women along.
At the onset of award season, we look at the future of Hollywood's Boys Club on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, we'll share an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show with Maureen Kelly Jonasson, the executive director of the Heritage Yemcomst Interpretive Center. And every Friday, we talk about the week's big stories with news director Dave Thompson. And Matt Olean will review two new movies tomorrow, The Disaster Artist and All the Money in the World. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.